Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. An election year like this year means Florida's politics will be on the national stage, from our pivotal role in choosing the next president to the balance of power in the United States Congress to policy fights in Tallahassee and the state legislature. All this political intrigue leads right back to Florida voters. Voters who have helped elect a Democratic president twice in the past 8 years. Voters who have sent a Republican supermajority to Tallahassee for almost 20 years. The deep red nature of Florida statewide politics has given way to a more purple hue for our national representatives. 2016 could bring changes to the partisan coloring thanks to shifting political districts. The lines are moving on the map. A growing population here in the state and a more prominent influence that Florida has exerted on national politics. This year can't help but be a year of politics, certainly, and that means Florida voters. The choices you make and have made will be front and center. And some of you may be voting in new political districts even without changing your address. The Florida League of Women Voters led the charge to redraw political boundaries throughout the Sunshine State. Pamela Goodman is the president of the group.
What has been occurring in Florida has been elected officials choosing their voters, drawing districts, choosing their voters, instead of voters choosing their elected officials, which is the way it's supposed to work in our democracy.
So new maps, new political districts, a new year, and a big election coming up for Florida. Will Florida Republicans help push Donald Trump toward the GOP nomination? Will Florida Democrats vote for a Clinton again? And how could moving political boundaries impact the partisan makeup for Florida's delegation in Congress and in Tallahassee? Voters, you decide. Let us know. Join in the Florida Roundup here today at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. On social media, Twitter and Facebook, look for us at WLRN. Greg Allen is the Miami correspondent for our partner, National Public Radio, NPR, with us in studio. Greg, Happy New Year to you.
Hi, Tom.
And in Tallahassee, Mary Ellen Klass is the Tallahassee Bureau Chief for our partner, the Miami Herald. Gary Fineout covering the state legislature for the Associated Press. Happy New Year to Mary Ellen and Gary to you as well.
Thank you.
Let's begin, Greg, here. How big are the differences in the new political boundaries compared to the last presidential election year in 2012?
Well, they'll be significantly different. They're a lot different from 2012. I don't think it'll affect the presidential election per se, but it will certainly affect the voting in the state Senate and in Congress. Here in South Florida, the one seat that will a lot of questions be raised about is the one that's held by Carlos Curbelo, mm-hmm. a Republican down here in Dade County, and he'll be facing probably he may be facing Annette Tadeo, the Democrat who's run before, ran as a ticket with Charlie Crist for lieutenant governor, and that'll be an interesting race. That is now a district that looks like it'll be much more Democratic than it was before, and you're going to see that in a few other places. Well, all over the state, the makeup's changed, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
It has all over the state, Mary Ellen. The congressional delegation that this state sends to Washington is tilted toward the Republicans. 20 Republicans, 7 Democrats. Greg mentioned the southernmost congressional district with Carlos Curbelo, which just a couple of years ago had been Democratic, is Republican again. What are the impact from these political boundary changes?
Well, I think the impact will be incremental at best. We will definitely see, I think, there will be Democratic gains throughout the state. Whether or not the Curbelo district goes for a Democrat or not, we'll wait to see. But the bigger impact is that there are now more competitive districts all across the state. And so that means it's a toss-up every 2 years. And I think that what we will see are a couple pickups. You know, the most likely would be 3 for Democrats in this election cycle. Mm-hmm. But over time, we will see that it'll be back and forth every couple of years.
It changes the political math, Gary Fineout. It changes the hue. Florida increasingly has become a purple state when it comes to national politics. Statewide, though, it has been decisively red Republican for the better part of 20 years.
Yes. I mean, the Florida legislature basically became under Republican control back in the 90s. And it was in concert with some of the redistricting that happened back at that time as well. This definitely will cause a shift. Now, I think, as Mary Ellen was saying, it's like, how much of a shift? I think on paper, the state Senate could theoretically flip to Democratic control. But let me emphasize, that's on paper. That doesn't mean that – well, it all depends on voter turnout. It sure. all depends on the candidates, and it depends on money. So
that would be significant gains, though. I mean, the Democrats have 14 seats compared to the GOP 26 now in the state Senate.
Correct. So you have a 26-14 split. So I think the Democrats themselves, of course, are already interestingly lowering expectations. They're already saying, no, we don't expect to take the state Senate. And if you think that you're reaching for it. However, I think that we would have a much different legislature at play. However, if you have, even if it's 23-17 or 21-19, you're talking about a much different dynamic. And we've always seen, especially in the state Senate, sometimes coalitions between Democrats and Republicans. That could happen with much more frequency. And the question you have to ask is whether or not all of this would have a moderating influence going forward, and including a moderating influence on the session we're about to start.
Yeah.
Because you have all these state senators who know, all 40 of them, they're on the ballot this fall.
Yeah. Let's put that to the listeners here at the Florida Roundup. How would you like a more moderate tone of politics out of the state house in Tallahassee? Are you okay with the partisanship? Would you like to see more partisanship, for that matter, when it comes to state policy? 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Broward County traditionally has been a Democratic stronghold. Miami-Dade County, Palm Beach County, traditionally Republican strongholds. Could that change with these political boundaries moving? Gary Finat with the AP, you talked about this being a presidential election year. Greg Allen, you've done some reporting about how that can impact, obviously, turnout. When that is applied to the state legislature balance of power, what's at stake?
Well, and that's, of course, traditionally here in Florida, Democrats turn out when there's a president on the ballot, not so much in off-year elections. And that's, we've seen that pattern for years. So we expect them to be a bigger Democratic turnout this year, a bigger turnout for both parties, actually, in the presidential race. And that a lot of times benefits Democrats has, depending on the candidate at the top of the ticket. And we'll see how that plays out. But if you, that could magnify the changes this year. But it's like Gary and Mary Ellen said, it's about what the candidates that get recruited that run in these districts and how it plays out. And a lot of that's still just taking shape right now. We don't really have a sense yet who's going to be running, at least in all the state Senate districts, I don't think.
All of the political horses are still kind of jockeying for position, Mary Ellen, and really kind of the whistle blows or the gate opens on Tuesday next week with the state legislature beginning in session. This is a political session. We'll be talking about some of those issues later on in this program. But broadly speaking, here, how do the state legislators, are they changing their approach to policymaking, not only because it's an election year, that would be clear, but because of the shifting political boundaries that they're now operating under that 6 months ago they didn't have?
Well, if you ask any of them, they will say absolutely not. however, I think that if you look at the dynamics of some of the issues that are going to, I think, be important flashpoints this session, you will definitely see that play out. For example, I think that the debate we've had over guns and open carry legislation, guns on campus, is a really important issue for Republican primary voters. It is not a popular issue in more moderate seats, purple seats. I think Democrats are less likely to be excited about seeing expansion of gun rights. And so you will watch as the traditionally maybe more conservative senators are now going to back away from endorsing those kind of bills. And in fact, I'm even wondering whether those bills will get a full hearing in all the Senate committees. That's just one example. I think we're going to also see some moderate, the Senate's last year was very moderate on some of the health care issues. I think we're going to see that play out again. And then when it comes to spending, the governor is asking for a $1 billion tax cut. Mm-hmm. The Senate's already said, well, we'll start at $250 million. And what they're talking about that we haven't really heard them talk much about in the past is investing in state agencies, putting money into eliminating waiting lists for the disabled or the elderly.
Yeah.
Those are things that, I think are moderating.
And we'll point out, since Governor Scott took office in January of 2011, all of the major industries have gained jobs. There's been more than a million new jobs added in the state of Florida. There's only one industry that has lost jobs. That's government. That's the only industry that's lost jobs under Governor Scott's administration. Let me go to the national scale here, Gary Fineout with the AP, because redistricting not playing a role, obviously, in the U.S. Senate race, the race to replace Marco Rubio. But did redistricting play a role in the candidates that we're seeing either on the Democratic or the GOP side?
Well, I think that redistricting, I mean, there were a series of dominoes that have been triggered in terms of candidates running in various races. And obviously, David Jolly, Republican congressman out of Pinellas County, he saw the handwriting on the wall in terms of the changes that were imminent for his congressional district. And so he jumped into the race for U.S. Senate as a Republican. And that triggered the decision by former Governor Charlie Crist, who's run for a lot of different offices, as we know, over the years, to basically decide that he's going to run for Congress for that seat that was held by Jolly. And so you've had things like that happen in terms of people making some of these political decisions. I mean, I think we're waiting for a lot of other dominoes to sort of fall in other parts of the state. Up here in North Florida, we're waiting to see what happens with U.S. Representative Gwen Graham, who's the daughter of former Governor Graham. And basically right now, as the way it stands, she has a very difficult battle ahead of her because her district has now been shifted into one that is very solidly Republican. And the decision is, does she fight that fight and try to run for reelection despite that change, or does she decide, you know what, I'm going to focus on something else, maybe a gubernatorial election in 2018, and I'm not going to run right now. And there's people like Dan Webster in Central Florida. So it's on and on. It's been an interesting kind of watching the dominoes.
And among those dominoes is clearly it's going to be a change in the faces for the Florida delegation to Washington, D.C., with the race for Senator Rubio's seat. Mary Ellen, you've got two Democratic representatives vying for the Democratic nomination. Alan Grayson from Orlando, Patrick Murphy from Palm Beach County and the northern stretches of our listening area. DeSantis in the Gulf Coast, and then, of course, Lieutenant Governor Lopez Cantera on the Republican side. This race for the U.S. Senate seat in Florida is likely to be one of the most expensive races in the nation. Clearly a lot of focus on this nationally because of Senator Rubio's entrance into the presidential race. But what's at stake for Florida in regards to this race?
Well, it's not only important for Florida, but it's important for the National Senate, in D.C., because it's an open seat, and it's very rare that you get an open seat in the U.S. Senate, and one in a state like Florida where it really could swing either way. So I think we will see a lot of money generated by whoever are the nominees and directed into the state. And, you know, it's the balance of power in Washington, which is a huge dynamic.
And a huge dynamic when it comes to the U.S. Senate, Greg Allen, with it's already relatively tight, certainly compared to the Republican majority that the GOP holds in the U.S. House.
Right, and Democrats are hopeful that they can win back control. And, if they a race like this one in Florida, it could be key to that. So that we'll see what happens. A lot of outside money, no doubt, will pour into Florida.
Absolutely, and a lot of that because of the presidential primary race as well. The first primary ballots, guys, go out for Florida in just 3 weeks, believe it or not, for the presidential primary. It's closed primary. You have to be registered as a Republican or Democrat to vote in that party's presidential primary selection. But the primary itself isn't until March 15th. We've got Iowa. We've got New Hampshire. We've got South Carolina. A lot of states ahead of us, Greg Allen. Will there still be a race by the time Republicans and Democrats vote in Florida?
I think on the Republican side, almost certainly. I think at this point, I'll be curious what the other people on the panel say, but I think anybody who thinks it's going to be settled by New Hampshire or South Carolina, even the Super Tuesday, the Southeast, the SEC primary, I don't think you can expect it's going to be solved by then. So Florida will be important, and this is a winner-take-all state. Whoever takes this on the Republican side gets all the votes.
Gary, how about it? A six-way race on the GOP side? Will it still be two or three horses in the race for the Democrats come March 15th in Florida?
For the Democrats?
Yeah. Or will it be a single horse still left in the race at that point?
Anything can happen. I think we have to think if you've got nearly half of the primaries already decided by the time Florida comes along, I don't know on the Democratic side I mean, you know, maybe something will happen when Sanders catches fire. But I mean, I would anticipate that by that time, you know, the Democrats will be coalescing around Clinton. And I think we at this point in time anticipate that Clinton will do fairly well in Florida. Let's not forget, even though the issue of the delegates was greatly unsettled in 2008, she did win Florida in 2008.
Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Right.
It was just a matter that the delegates at the time didn't count.
Right.
So.
Right. Mm-hmm. And how about Mary Ellen on the Republican side? Do you agree with Greg Allen still could, be a half dozen GOPers in the race, including, three or four Floridians still by March 15th?
Well, I don't think the Floridians drop out until Florida. And I think that's, you know, that this could make or Florida will make or break them. So it will, you know, I think the Florida primary will be significant for a lot of things. It could be the end of the stragglers at that point. And I do think it's going to be decisive for a lot of whoever is the front runner out of Florida.
I thought it was an interesting development, Governor Scott's op-ed in the USA Today this
yes.
week about, you know, all but endorsing Donald Trump.
Yeah, we spoke with him while he was at the Broward workshop on Wednesday trying to get some kind of clarity on whether or not he would endorse anybody, and if so, would it be Mr. Trump? And in fact, the governor would not go quite that far, and he went as far as I think he's going to go right now with the USA Today editorial. But Gary, find out, will Governor Scott and his endorsement carry much weight in the Republican primary as we approach March 15th?
Well, I think what we're seeing is I don't anticipate that Governor Scott will do a bona fide 100% endorsement. He still feels, from what you can tell, based on his statements and his patterns, he still has a sting about the 2010 and the fact that the establishment, quote-unquote, establishment Republicans in Florida were all aligned against him. And he has shown a great unwillingness to, you know, do a full – but what that said, I think that op-ed and his statements on television this week were as close to an endorsement of Donald Trump as he is going to get. And I think it does underscore something. It is kind of one of the untold stories here. But the fact of the matter is that Jeb Bush and Governor Scott, they don't really get along.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no warm relationship between them. And he doesn't really have a warm relationship with Rubio as well. We don't have time to get into it, but just look at the status of the Republican Party and what's going on with Republicans here in Florida. It's very fractured. And so I don't know if a Governor Scott full-out endorsement of Donald Trump would make a huge amount of difference. I think a lot of it's going to depend on, you know, money and organization and things of that nature.
Along those lines, let me ask you, Gary, you know, Florida with a closed primary system requires somebody to declare a political party in order to participate March 15th. And that's the party whose party you vote in. Does that system favor the establishment Republicans in the state like Governor Bush or Senator Rubio, or does it put Trump at a disadvantage?
I would dare say that, yes, it does put Trump at a disadvantage because you're talking about established voters and the fact that you need to know who is more likely to go to the polls and things of that nature. That's why organization matters.
And I would also add that is why even if Rick Scott came out and endorsed Donald Trump, I'm not sure it would have the influence of Charlie Crist endorsing John McCain on the eve of the Florida primary. I think that it is because so much of the Florida establishment and the people who raise the money, the people who handle the ground game, the people who are the workers are either Jeb or Marco affiliates. And I think that Rick Scott is aware of that. And endorsing Trump would just make everybody mad.
We're going to go from the White House to the State House next here on the Florida Roundup. Those state issues out there, expanding gun rights, open carry in Florida, campus carry in Florida. Do you support that? What about the expansion of gaming? Would you like to see more slot machines in Palm Beach or Miami-Dade County? Get them lined up here at 800-743-9576. State politics coming up next on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-9576. From guns and gaming to manufacturing and marijuana. All next on the Florida Roundup. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. 2016, the year of politics in Florida, politics in the State House, politics in the White House. All roads lead through the Sunshine State. Let's talk about more national politics before we move on to state politics. In Miami, Dave is joining the Florida Roundup. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, it's Dave in Miami. I just wanted to comment that, along with myself, several of my friends who are formerly independent registered voters who voted for Obama twice have re-registered to vote for Mr. Trump in the primary.
So registered as a Republican to vote in Florida's primary.
That's correct. But I will be voting for Hillary in the national election.
Mischief maker.
A mischief maker, Dave, in Miami there. So it's more of a vote, what, for Clinton than for Trump at
well,
the primary?
Well, it's several things. First of all, if Hillary can't beat any Republican, I like Trump better than the rest of them, but I think she can beat them all.
Dave, we appreciate it. Good luck with that vote there in March 15th.
I've got five other people that have joined me.
All right. There's five votes right there, apparently, guys, for Donald Trump in the close primary. Let's go to Tallahassee now, folks. The state legislature begins this election year law writing session on Tuesday next week. Gambling, guns, health care, the Everglades, education, manufacturing marijuana, all on this two-month agenda. A lot of work to be done in a short period of time. Should Florida expand medical marijuana use? Do you support the millions of dollars earmarked to help restore the Everglades? What about open carry of a firearm? What about carrying a gun on a college campus? 800-743-9576 here on the Florida Roundup. Greg Allen covers the Southeast for our partner, the NPR, from Miami. Mary Ellen Kloss from Tallahassee with our partner, the Miami Herald. And Gary Fineout covering the Florida State Legislature for the Associated Press. So Governor Scott's priorities in one word, jobs. That's what he's been consistent about in his first election campaign, his reelection campaign, and each and every state legislative session. It has been about jobs. He wants to cut state taxes primarily for manufacturers and retailers in Florida, and he wants to get more money for the state's economic development group.
I want to make a $1 billion investment in reduction of taxes so we diversify this economy and help our small businesses grow so we get more jobs. I would invest $250 million in Enterprise Florida, which is our public-private economic development process around the state, so we get more jobs in the state.
Get more jobs in the state. Mary Ellen Kloss with our partner, the Miami Herald. Will he get what he wants?
I think this will be an interesting year for the governor because it will test how willing he is to compromise. The legislature has all but rejected his $1 billion package. But they haven't ruled out the fact that they may be willing to pass a significant number of tax cuts. They just don't necessarily agree that they should be the ones that Rick Scott wants. I think that that will make how willing is Rick Scott to kind of work things out. We have not seen him really engage, negotiate with the legislature very much in his, and this will be his sixth term, so we'll see how well he, how much he's learned.
You know, on Wednesday when I saw him in Broward County, Gary, I asked him just that question about how engaged he's going to be in Tallahassee this year. And, you know, he looked at me with those eyes wide open, those eyes that look that you know very well, Gary Fineout. And he said, look at the results that we've had in past legislative sessions. We've gotten the tax cuts that that I've wanted. We've gotten the job investment numbers that we've wanted. He looks to past precedents and said, you know, I haven't been pounding the pavement to the State House each and every day during session. And he calls it a win.
Well, I think if you were to take a close look at his record. I mean, what's interesting about this year is the fact that he is kind of going back to a bit of a large ask of the legislature. When he tried this in 2011, when he came out with a really expansive, aggressive agenda, lots of much more tax cuts that he's asking for this year, mm-hmm. and total revamping in the budget, he really didn't get much of what he wanted from the Florida legislature that was dealing with a recession. And I think that his most successful session, if you are somewhat cynical, you would note occurred in 2014 when he was on the ballot for reelection. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he had a very limited agenda last year, and he kind of got about half of what he wanted from the legislature last year. And I think the situation is that, you know, I think that the legislature is going to – because there's a lot of competing factions at play, not the least of which is some of it is you've got people who are like, well, you know, we're worried about 2 years out, 3 years out, and we're not going to make financial decisions that we think are going to put us in the hole 2 to 3 years from now. And, you know, and thank you very much, Governor, but this is the way we feel. I mean, do I think he's going to, you know, be completely rebuffed? Well, no, of course not. I think it's a Republican legislature. He's a Republican governor. Mm-hmm. They know he has a veto pen. They know he can wipe out their priorities if need be. So I think they're going to be willing to work with him. But that's what, to what Mary Ellen said, it's about compromise. And yeah. Like, so what are you willing to give up to sort of meet us halfway?
One of the places where, you know, in the days leading up to the session beginning on Tuesday, that we've begun to see some Republican resistance to the governor has been on gaming, Greg Allen. Florida may not be done expanding gaming, at least according to the compact that the governor has come to with the Seminole Tribe of Florida. The proposal is to split horse and greyhound racing, highlight gaming, split those licenses to allow for slot machines in Dade and Palm Beach counties. What seemed to be perhaps a shoe-in just a few weeks or a few months ago because of the billions of dollars in state money that are attached to this could be some more Republican resistance now.
Right, and I think what you've seen here is, as we've been discussing, is that the party is not coalesced. I think sometimes people think the governor is the head of the party, and he is the head of the Republican Party in Florida, but it is really not coalesced behind him. And as Gary started to allude to, the state party is actually in trouble right now. They're money-wise, they're not raising the money they once did. There's been a fracturing there. Governor Scott is not raising money for the state party. He's raising it for his own own funds. So I think people have to look, if you're in the party, and think, you know, what team are we all on the same team here? And when you get to this issue of gaming, I think it's going to come to fore. There's a gaming conference in Orlando this week. I just read in the Miami Herald today this one, a key senator there says that it doesn't look to him that they will get a gaming proposal through this year. Who knows? We'll have to wait and see. But it's not going to be a slam dunk by any means.
And Mary Ellen, does that mean that these dollars for gaming won't go into the state if the legislature doesn't approve what the governor has already okayed with the Seminole Tribe?
Well, it means that the tribe could continue to pay on the existing compact as a good show of support, but they will likely continue their lawsuit against the state. And you know, I think that it does tee things up next year, which will be a lot less difficult for legislators because it's not an election year. So I do think that there's a possibility they pass part of the compact and try and punt the rest of it till after November.
If I could chime in real quick, I mean, I think it's important to note that the $3 billion figure that's been associated with that new compact, if you look at the fine print, that money doesn't kick in until 2017. So it wasn't ever going to be an issue of that money was going to come in this year. The issue, as Mary Ellen is correct about, is it's the money that the Seminoles are currently earning off blackjack tables that they have not removed. And so part of the reason is if you get a compact this year, then you sort of bless the infusion of that money. And it's you know, I think if you do the rough math, back of the envelope math, it's about $100 million more a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you're talking about in terms of – so it is entirely theoretical under the way that we're talking about this that you don't have to solve this right now in terms of having a compact passed in order to guarantee that those future payments are going to come in.
The governor also points to that compact and some of the job growth that he has called for within gaming with the Seminole Tribe that has been pledged under this. And it gets back again, Greg Allen, to this echoing statement, the laser focus that the Scott administration has had on jobs, even 5-6 years after the end of the Great Recession.
He is someone with one idea, and that's and he stays on message, and that's the one message he has repeatedly, and he kind of wears it out, I think, personally. But I think that he feels that this is the message he can take further, and he may run for higher office on this message that he's helped bring back Florida's economy and he helped create jobs, and clearly that's something that people really do care about. So we'll see.
He has pledged some dollars, Mary Ellen, to the Everglades. Looks like there won't be much of a fight this legislative session over spending millions of dollars on restoring the Glades. This is a big difference from years past when the environment was a place that the state didn't necessarily spend a big chunk of money and certainly would wrestle over it during session. But this came out several months ago with the blessing of both the Senate and the House leadership.
Yes, and it's basically to give to dedicate this money in perpetuity to Everglades, which they have used state money over the years, and it's been a changing amount that's gone into Everglades restoration, but there's been no guaranteed and dedicated funding source. And I think they're also using this to help appease all the critics of the way the legislature has managed the Amendment 1 initiative, mm-hmm. and where they have put money into areas that many environmentalists said were not appropriate.
What's the trade-off here, though, to get the support of Republicans and Democrats, for that matter, in North Florida to guarantee this money for essentially what is oftentimes seen as a South Florida issue?
But the interesting thing is the South Florida legislators will always argue that they are the net contributor to the state budget.
Sure.
And so, you know, they deserve to have this amount of money come back to something that is such a vital source to the both the economy and the ecology of South Florida.
Help us sort through the other environmental issue that may or may not be on the ballot this fall for voters, and it is the solar amendments, plural. There could be two of them, one of them backed by the major power utility here in South Florida, the other one backed by an out-of-state alternative energy interest. Gary Fineout with the Associated Press in Tallahassee. I think it's fair to say both of these can be very confusing for the layman if you're not into the weeds when it comes to solar energy. And what are the chances that any of these are going to be on the ballot?
Well, I think we've seen enough indication of the last few weeks that think that the one pushed by the alternative energy supporters doesn't look like it's going to make the 2016 ballot. There is an ongoing dispute with their vendor that they got to collect the petition signatures, and the deadline is February 1st. You have to have all your signatures in and verified in order to make the ballot. But meanwhile, the other one, which Mary Ellen probably has a better feel for the analysis on this, but basically appears to enshrine in the Constitution things that are kind of already allowed. Mm-hmm. So, so it's just kind of interesting. I guess the voters will vote on something that isn't really going to make a huge difference to change things from the way they are now. But I think the issue, of course, is that I think for the utility groups, their goal was to create an alternative to the amendment that they didn't like. And so that amendment's not going to be probably won't be on the ballot now. So I guess that they'll view it's a win either way.
Mary Ellen, how do we assess this, in Florida as utility consumers? Is this a win for the potential of solar power? Is it a win for the incumbent utility companies?
Well, if you've got to take off the veil of what's been going on here, and it's pretty clear that the entrenched utilities in the state have put up records amounts of money. I mean, a couple million dollars, and the bulk of it has come from FPL, and that's only the stuff that we can trace, to create this alternative amendment that is really designed, I think, to confuse voters and make it look as though they're signing a petition for something that is going to advance solar energy, and it's doing nothing. So in many ways, it's a win for the utilities, and it really does show their incredible power. There is a bill before the legislature that would do a lot of what the solar choice folks, the alternative energy folks, have done with their initiative. And it's being proposed by a conservative Republican and Fred Costello. And he has pitched the idea, and there's a pretty strong chance his bill will barely get a hearing.
Yeah.
So that alternative is out there, but there's just no institutional will to challenge the big utilities.
Let's move about the institutional will when it comes to another ballot measure that could be on the November ballot for voters, and that could be the potential expansion of medical marijuana. This was an issue, Greg Allen, that received a larger percentage of support than Governor Scott did, but not enough percentage of support in order to make it into the state constitution. Could be back in 2016.
Right. You need 60% to get a ballot referendum passed in Florida, and didn't make it last time. The supporters think they will make it this time. Again, presidential election year, bigger turnout. But, you know, I think a lot of people thought they would do well last time. That we'll have to see what kind of opposition gets mounted, because that was a key factor last time in keeping the vote down.
And also, Mary Ellen, see if there's any preemptive legislative efforts on the part of Tallahassee to try to take some of the sting out of the constitutional amendment. We saw that with the Charlotte's Web legislation, which did make way for very limited use of cannabis oil for a very limited number of diseases, but did open up Florida for 5 licensed nurseries to begin growing marijuana in the state.
There is some legislation actually being proposed in both the House and the Senate. It's gotten some hearings. I think it will continue to get some hearings, but the big question is, where is the governor on it? I think, judging by the way he has handled the administration of the rulemaking for the existing marijuana legislation, it's pretty clear that his administration is establishing hurdles to, as opposed to allowing this to move forward. So I'm not sure the governor would support that expanded language if it were to pass.
A couple of months ago, a legislative committee approved a measure that could push for the open carry of guns in the state of Florida. This legislative debate, of course, guys, comes this week now, with President Obama pushing to tighten gun licensing requirements for firearm sales. Khalid Akawi is a Florida gun seller. He owns 8 gun stores around the state, as well as a traveling gun show.
I don't see a whole lot of restrictions. He wants to do background checks. Well, we have been doing background checks for 20 years now on sales at gun shows or at stores. So that has no effect on Florida. We've been doing background checks.
So he may have been doing some background checks. Mary Ellen, with this national focus on gun licensing, the previous efforts in the fall during committee weeks to expand gun laws, wherein lies any middle ground or what the legislature may do in the months ahead?
I think it does raise the question again of whether the only bills that are moving are bills that would expand gun rights, allowing people who now can carry a concealed weapons permit, for example, to carry it outside, you know, walk into a public building or anywhere
and keep it in a holster,
and have
but
that
put
gun
it on your
exposed
hip,
on a holster. And I think what the national debate has done is made it a little bit more of a political litmus test for candidates, which may make it more difficult for those in moderate seats to side with the gun rights advocates.
Guns, gaming, solar power, the environment, all of it on the agenda in the weeks ahead in Tallahassee. Joining us from the capital city, from our partner, the Miami Herald, Mary Ellen Klass, also from the Associated Press covering the state legislature from Tallahassee, is Gary Fineout. Thanks to both of you. And Greg Allen here in Miami, always great to see you, sir, as well.
My pleasure.
All right, we've got plenty more to come here on the Roundup. Stick with us. The fight against FLACA in the year ahead. That's next. We're back on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Education, preparation, and a statewide ban on all designer drugs. That's how a Broward grand jury says FLACA should be fought in the year ahead. The drug was a contributing factor in 61 deaths in Broward County in the past 15 months. Law enforcement and healthcare officials hope that 2016 does not continue that trend. FLACA is just the latest designer drug concocted from a brew of chemicals, oftentimes chemicals imported to South Florida from China. These compounds change quickly to stay ahead of the law, changing formulas in the effort to be legal, but still plenty potent and in some cases deadly. So with the release of this grand jury report this week on the drug in Broward County, it's the fight against FLACA. It'll be stepped up in 2016. Do you know someone who's used it? Have you used it? Have you encountered someone on it? Join the Florida Roundup as we tackle FLACA in the year ahead. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, and all over social media. Look for us on Twitter and Facebook, WLRN. Tanya Alanez is a Sun Sentinel reporter covering crimes and cops in Broward County, and she has concentrated on FLACA in the past many, many months. So, Tanya, how bad is the FLACA problem as the new year begins?
Well, bad enough that as you said, the Broward Medical Examiner has determined that the drug contributed to or factored into at least 61 deaths in just the last 15 months. Bad enough that the Broward State Attorney's Office has seen a 7-fold increase in FLACA-related felonies in just the first half of this last year. And bad enough that Broward Crime Labs analyzed more FLACA cases than any other county in the nation, according to DEA statistics.
Why Broward County for FLACA?
That's kind of an impossible question to answer. You know, there's a lot of ideas. You know, some people say, you know, once the pill mills, you know, got closed down, that users and sellers were looking for the next, you know, drug to, you know, replace it. That could be it.
Are we seeing the same sellers who were behind the pill mill selling these compounds?
I don't think so. I think with this, we're seeing more street level dealers. Not doctors opening up clinics.
Right. Yeah. These aren't at shopping malls or strip malls. This is street corners and under street lamps in back alleys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And probably a lot of not just, you know, on the streets, but in the clubs too, in the nightclubs, in the party scene.
Yeah, we talk about the 61 deaths, tragic. You talk about the sevenfold increase in crimes that had been allegedly committed with folks perhaps under the influence of FLACA. But compare the public safety threat and the public health risk to other illegal drugs, drugs that have been on the streets for decades.
I don't know that since crack cocaine, we've seen something that really kind of like rocketed the landscape this much. Certainly, we still see, especially in Miami, lots of deaths from other synthetic drugs. Mm-hmm. Fentanyl seems to be more the problem in Miami versus FLACA and Broward. Why? No one totally knows. But it seems to be creating more problems in our region than anything we've seen in a long time.
Let's go straight to the phones here. Carmen is joining the Florida Roundup from Fort Lauderdale. Carmen, go ahead.
Yes. What are the measures that are going to be implemented to stop the drug use of FLACA?
A little bit of a scratchy phone line, but what are the measures implemented to stop or reduce the use of FLACA in Broward County? The grand jury came up with a number of recommendations, 18 of them. The biggest, perhaps, Tanya, was the statewide ban of a broad range of designer drugs, not specific chemical compounds.
That is the most explicit and probably the most hopeful solution for most people involved with this. It's legislation being drafted right now, supposedly in the final stages, by Attorney General Pam Bondi. They're calling it the 2016 Florida Designer Drugs Enforcement Act.
But as we know, making a drug illegal does not stop the illegal use of it. And by no means does that mean I'm advocating legal use of it either. But this is only part of the advocacy that the grand jury provided this week.
Yeah. I mean, a ban would make it harder. And, you know, you'd have to try harder, look harder, and the costs will probably go up. But and that's been a big problem with FLACA, too. Why it's so prevalent is it's been so cheap.
Jim is joining the conversation from Nova Southeastern University. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking this topic. It's been a critical issue in Broward County and really spreading across Florida. The good news is, as of October 1, very much because of South Florida's efforts, the government of China has banned the manufacture of FLACA and 115 other drugs. Since that time, in November and December, we've seen declines significant in the number of hospital-related emergency visits in the Broward Health System, as well as a decline in the number of treatment admissions at the Broward Addiction Recovery Center.
Jim, clearly this is something that you follow on a professional basis with Nova Southeastern University. Can you attribute that to the lack of supply on the streets?
I think that is having a dramatic effect, and probably our best bet is banning it from the source, and the Chinese government has done that. They've been effective in changing other synthetic that are distributed, as well a new universal ban based on the pharmaceutical action of the drug rather than on its chemical structure will make it possible to ban substances even before they appear.
Jim, we appreciate the insights here you've provided us. Tanya, the grand jury didn't really tackle the source of the chemicals, the Chinese source. What Jim's talking about really is a foreign policy, a foreign trade issue, as much as it is a prevention on the supply domestically, locally.
Yes, in fact, Broward County sent a delegation of law enforcement to China right after they had made the ban to just support it and to talk about the importance of it and to make sure they understood the impact we were encountering here from these drugs.
Michael is joining us on line four here on the Florida Roundup from Hollywood. Michael, you're an emergency room doctor, is that right?
Yes, sir. I'm actually an ER doctor on my way to work. But I've done also some lecturing on Flocka, and I wanted to just also add that two of the major issues that I'm concerned about with Flocka is, number one, the safety effects that it has on law enforcement and fire rescue personnel because of the physiological effects of the drug and how altered and strong the patients are. And then number two, the ultimate effect and the cost burden on the taxpayers and the public at large. I mean, one Flocka patient, I had one patient that required a 5-day ICU admission just to keep the patient sedated. Mm. And we're talking about bills in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then with lawmakers, ultimately these patients eventually get discharged from the hospital and they go right back out and use again. I had one patient that was readmitted within one day of discharge after a 7-day admission in the hospital for Flocka.
Michael, admittedly it's anecdotal, but previous caller Jim noted that there's been a decrease in Flocka issues really in the fourth quarter of last year, in part because of the involvement with the Chinese officials and the ban of the chemicals in China, which had been imported into the United States and Broward. Have you noticed any anecdotal slippage in Flocka incidents in your emergency room over the last couple of weeks?
I would actually agree with that. I feel as though the number of clinical cases on the ground has been somewhat less than it was during the height of it last year. So I would actually agree with his observation.
Michael, we appreciate the insights there from the ER, an emergency room doctor from Hollywood. Tanya, I want to ask you, the Broward County grand juries have looked into illegal drug use in the past. They looked into pill mills, for instance. To what end do these types of grand jury reports come to?
That grand jury report with the pill mills is the only one I have experience with, so that's the only one I can speak to. But the recommendations, some of the primary recommendations made in that report definitely came to light. And as a result, we've definitely seen a decrease in pill mills and overdoses and just overall crisis.
So some of the grand jury recommendations in the pill mills found their way into public policy. And so the process precedent being passed here, but the precedence has been that these grand jury reports do matter when it comes to policymakers, and they listen.
If people listen, and Flocka has gotten a lot of vocal attention, so I think they're listening now.
Certainly has gotten a lot of attention, not only with ER doctors and police and fire and rescue and policymakers, but also reporters like yourself, Tanya. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Tanya Alanez with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. That is the Florida Roundup here for today. We want to invite you to join our new Facebook group where you can post your comments about today's show. Let us know what you're talking about. It's facebook.com/groups/TheFloridaRoundup. Our program is produced by Julia Duba and Alicia Zuckerman. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Chibeli Herrera. Our program director here at WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. And our technical supervisor for the program, Paul Leary. Thanks, Paul. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.